down in his little introduction in the world of children's personal, social, and emotional development. Her fantastic book, Young Children's Social, Emotional, Personal Development, available from Sage Publications, is now in its fourth edition. And it's still my go-to book whenever I do anything about children's PSED. It's just a fantastic book linked with loads of theory and practice. Marion also leads training and keynotes at conferences on children's personal, social, emotional development, as well as many other aspects of children's development. And certainly whenever I've seen her, she's always done that to great acclaim. And the sorts of comments that we get are inspirational, supportive and thought-provoking. I'm absolutely delighted that Marion's been able to join us today on the Early Years Web Summit, all about personal, social, emotional development. Welcome to the Early Years Web Summit, Marion Dowling.
Thank you, Cathy. Do you know, it's a real pleasure to take part in this summit because PSED is very close to my heart. A nursery head teacher said to me some years ago now, you know, our job here is to nurture children, but also to help grow the adequate person. And I absolutely agreed with her.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. It's such a bedrock of children's development, isn't it? Yeah, that's a lovely way to put it as well. It is a massive topic. It covers so many areas of children's development. So today we're just going to focus on two specific areas, children's independence and children's self-regulation. Would you like to just give us a brief introduction, first of all, into what we mean by children's independence and how you would see that in children and maybe where that sits with the UK government as well?
Thank you, Cathy. Just let me continue with this notion of adequacy, because I think it's fundamental, really. And most of us would recognise an adequate person. You know, somebody who can relate easily to other people, good interpersonal skills, live their lives by a clear moral code, and can handle their feelings and also empathise with the feelings of others. I think that sort of person, when difficulties come along in life, as they do, they face them bravely and make decisions clearly. Yeah. Now, these people very often are full of vigour and a good sense of humour, which is important. Regardless of their intellectual capacities, you know, these people seem equipped to lead their lives fully and also to deal with problems. Now, that's a very rough and ready description of adequacy, I know, but I hope that you would agree with me, all of you, that really we need to nurture, recognise and promote these qualities in young children. Young children are growing up in the springtime of their lives. There's everything to play for. Their growth is embryonic. And so the young baby waits for us to give us messages, he responds, and he takes our nurture.
And as you say, that is from babyhood, isn't it? It's right from the very babe in arms.
Yes, it is. So shall I move on to independence then?
Yes, please. Could you tell us a little bit about children's independence, please?
Yeah. I think you said originally, you asked if it was a priority of governments. Well, I think they would like to say, yes, it is. And we demonstrate that. I have severe reservations about that. We live, you know, in a very controlling culture, very competitive as well. And this is coupled with our young children being urged to achieve as much as possible as early as possible. I think that, you know, people recognise that now, parents and some practitioners, and they see this as an opportunity to urge their young children to accelerate their learning, particularly in mathematics and literacy. But, you know, you and I know that achievement is much broader than this, and that's really why I've decided to look at independence and self-regulation, because I think they're absolutely basic to development.
So could you describe for me what being independent would look like in a child? What would a practitioner recognise in a child as them being independent?
Yeah, well, you know, all practitioners, I believe, think that independence is important. That's a given. But there are many different understandings of this. Just two broad headings. Some people would say most important is for a child to make a good transition from parents, separate happily from parents, particularly when they're going into a nursery environment or if they're actually going to a childminder even, and also to attend to their personal needs, going to the toilet unaided, learning to wash themselves, and indeed feed themselves and dress themselves. So those, I think, are given high profile. Yes. Other people would say, look, surely the priority is for young children to learn to think for themselves. Mm-hmm. Now, in fact, all of these aspects are important for independence. You know, they all come together, really. Yeah. And it's just terribly important that all of us recognise that babyhood is the start of independence. You know, young babies make decisions about what they want to eat, what they want to play with, and actually whose company they prefer. Given an enabling environment, babies really do thrive in starting to make decisions for themselves.
I think that's such a good point, isn't it, that we often think about independence as being that sort of preschool skill, ready to go to school sort of thing. But as you say, babies make choices as well, don't they? And they can be very vocal about their choices, can babies? So, yes, absolutely. So independence really starts from that babyhood, and it covers such a wide range of things, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I have got an example of this, if you want to have, because one of the inhibitors, I think, of independence is when children are overprotected. That is a factor with some children and some parents, and even key persons. With key persons, they tend to overprotect children. But let me just talk about Elise for a moment, because I met this child and I met her parents, and a lovely little girl of two. Very loving parents, an only child, and Elise was very well cared for. But the parents never allowed Elise to go outside unless she was on a rein, and indoors she was never allowed to climb a stair, let alone a staircase. I mean, she was always carried. So at 3.5, this was continuing, at 3.5 she started in a nursery school. Well, the workforce, the people there, gently tried to persuade the parents to allow Elise a little more flexibility, a little more freedom. But by that time, you know, Elise at 3.5, her movements were very tentative, and she was very, very reluctant to take the smallest risk. And this continued. Now, I thought these parents want the best for Elise, but they've never allowed her to learn through trial and error. And really, by 4 even, if we look at Elise, her physical development and her levels of confidence were delayed.
But as you say, the parents are trying to do the very best for their child, aren't they? And they think that they're doing that by keeping her safe, but by not giving her the independence, that's going to be detrimental. And that's really interesting. That's not just about personal, social and emotional development. As you say, that's going to be physical development. That's going to have manifestations in all areas of learning and development, isn't it? What a good example.
Well, we have to, you know, I think we have to look out for that. So loving parents can feel they're doing the best, but that doesn't always happen, does it, really? I don't know if you want me to move on to self-regulation.
Have you got any top tips or strategies for practitioners in developing independence? We've identified that it is so important. What sort of things can practitioners do? And you've already identified some of that they're being supportive with the children that they've got coming in, and they've identified that there's an extra need there. But what other sorts of things can practitioners do to support children's independence?
Well, I do think giving them scope to make decisions for themselves. Mm. And, you know, if we look at an environment, for example, an environment that they can't always be spacious, but to be equipped with continuous provision, the same resources out day after day. The quality of continuous provision has a huge impact on children's play, but this allows them to make choices, you know. So I think that's very important. We also need children to become independent. They need to feel in control of things. And I think that having a predictable program, particularly for very young children and new children, is important. So a visual timeline is helpful for children. They can actually see time passing, you know, particularly if there are little items that can be removed from a line. So we've had registration now, and then we're going to have choosing time, or whatever you like to call it. Yeah. So yeah. I think that gives them a sense of security and makes them feel well, they do know what's coming next, you know, rather than being in a complete fog about whatever is in the hands of the adults.
Yes, you know? Absolutely. And as adults, we like that. If we go to a conference or if we're going out somewhere, we like to know what time we've got to be there, when's break going to be. We need to know all that, don't we? Yeah, yeah.
So it is a matter of giving children information. Mm-hmm. Really, really important. But I'll come back to a couple of those points later on.
Interesting. So could we just move on then to self-regulation? Could you give us a little explanation of what self-regulation actually is, and why that is so important, why you've chosen to talk about that today, please?
Yes. Well, I decided on this because we hear more and more of that term, and we didn't in the past. But what exactly does it mean? I think people use it without really understanding. You know, it's quite similar to independence.
Yeah.
Those of us who are self-regulated, and there are gaps in self-regulation of adults as well as children, but those of us who are in control of our feelings, our behaviour, and our learning. And we're in control rather than being controlled. That's the most important aspect, I think. So why it's so important? Well, it's quite difficult to actually describe this because it wasn't a term that was always used.
Yeah.
But we do need to get children to restrain their impulses, and adults. We all know of adults who are very impulsive, you know.
Yes.
And
yeah.
If we are hostage to our impulses and emotions, it makes it much more difficult for us to persevere and concentrate on things. So I think harnessing impulse is tremendously important. Stop doing something, for instance, that we like doing, and do something we know we have to do. And translated for a young child, you know, if they're playing in role play and enjoying it, but they know full well that the session's coming to an end and it is time to clear up, you know, that is necessary. Now, that's where you see, at an early age, self-regulation coming in, because some children will immediately go ahead and do that. They know what's necessary, and others tend to ignore. So, you know, that's another one, really, that is important. Good old Bridget Plowden in 1964, I think, she coined a wonderful phrase. She said, children should be agents in their own learning.
Yes.
Of course, you know, that just encapsulates one of the main elements of self-regulation.
Mm-hmm.
Being in charge or managing your learning in the 60s was beginning to be seen as independent. Being important, rather, although there was still a lot of control.
Yeah.
But today, I believe it's imperative because, you know, our children are growing up in a world where there are no certainties any longer. And so they need to be flexible and adapt. They do need to make thoughtful and informed choices. And that sounds very grand for young children, but it's the beginning. We need to encourage those sorts of things, you see, because to a large extent, these children are going to be in charge of their own destinies.
Yes, yes. More so than ever in history, really, aren't they? Yeah.
Absolutely right. And we must be quite clear that there's a huge difference now between self-regulation and compliancy. In the past, compliancy was recognised and highlighted as a good thing. If children followed the instructions of adults, if their behaviour was compliant and basically they did as they were told, they were regarded as good pupils, you know, and probably do well in life. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, we see that that can lead to a culture of dependency, and really children don't have the opportunity in that culture to think and learn for themselves, and that's what we really want to get to. Just want to take a little look at the characteristics of learning.
Because oh, the characteristics of effective learning. Yes, please.
Well, it's my, I expect it is yours, Kathy, but it's one of my favourite parts of the early years foundation stage. It really does chime with us, you know, and I'm sure everybody watching this will be very familiar with the three characteristics. Playing and exploring, children engaged as agents in their own learning. So yeah, there's Loudon being echoed. Active learning, children motivated to learn, hungry to learn, curious, asking questions. And that's such a driver, isn't it? Because without that motivation, we can't go anywhere. We can't make children learn. Absolutely. But we can harness their motivation, and that takes some skill sometimes. And finally, the third one, creating and thinking critically, you know, having their own ideas. Yes, being given ideas, but actually making them their own, personalising, making links in their learning. So thinking to themselves, yeah, that little dog in the story we had today, that's like my grand's dog at home. So making those links between certain things, and then choosing ways to do things. So all of these three aspects are distinct, but they can all come together. And together they really do contribute strongly to self-regulation.
Yes. Absolutely. As you say, you need to have that sense of self-regulation, to have the critical thinking, to have that curiosity to continue to investigate, don't you? You don't just give up at the first opportunity and walk away from it. Yeah.
I think it's rather a pity that term wasn't used in the early years foundation stage, but there we are, you know, when we actually unpick the elements, they're all there to promote this.
Yes, of course. And in some respects, this isn't a new idea. This hasn't just come in with the 2008 EYFS. Theorists have been talking about types of self-regulation for a number of years, haven't they? Just take us through a couple of theorists that maybe this is grounded in?
Okay, yes, I'm glad you said that, because in fact it isn't a new idea, although the term itself is quite new, you know. Let me just start very briefly with Piaget, who sometimes is discredited these days, but you know, he was an education giant in his time. And one of the things that Piaget stated strongly was that children don't learn things by being told. He saw them as little scientists. And, you know, our job, which we would see much wider now, but he sees the adult's job as providing those experiences that children can then make sense of in order to move on in their learning. So that's Piaget. Two others who I think are very important, Vygotsky and Bruner. Now, both of these eminent psychologists believed strongly that learning was social. That, you know, we didn't learn by ourselves, we learned with other people. And Vygotsky is famously known for saying, well, what a child does in cooperation with others today, he will eventually learn to do for himself. I think that's a bit of a paraphrase, but that was the sense of his message. And Vygotsky introduced the ZPD, the zone of proximal development, which always sounds very technical, but actually it's the gap between what children know and are independent in doing and the proximal step, the next step in learning that they must take. And that to me is tremendously important because it does highlight the need for very close observation of children and then that informed guess as to what comes next. And Bruner did agree with Vygotsky, took on board a lot of his notions, but very usefully went a step further and actually introduced scaffolding, a way that adults can support young children. And the great thing about scaffolding is that it's bespoke. It's bespoke to every child, you know. So one child might need a very light scaffold to help them move on, and lasting for a very brief period of time. And others might need a more substantial scaffold to actually give them time to move on to quite a big gap in their learning, and eventually they will be independent. When they're independent, when they are self-regulated, the scaffold is removed. So all three of those, I mean, I don't believe we can teach self-regulation. I don't think that there's a lesson that will teach it. But what we can do is follow the theories of these eminent people and apply some of the notions, the zone of proximal development and the emphasis on really looking at children closely and scaffolding. And we can scaffold their development in everyday activities.
For me, scaffolding's such a great phrase because it's visually it's a lovely image, and the idea that, as you say, some of them are going to be more permanent than others, but it isn't a total solution. You're not just spoon feeding them the answer. This is something you're supporting them and you're expecting to step away. And of course that links very closely with that idea of independence. That's what you're giving them, that independence afterwards, to step away.
That's what we're working for. Yes, it is.
So you said that you don't think we can actually teach self-regulation, but there must be some strategies or some top tips that maybe practitioners could put into practice to help self-regulation.
Yeah, let me just give an example and turn to physical development. I think physical development is quite a useful one to expand on because we're very aware now, we've been made very aware of the importance of physical development, you know, forest schools, children being active to stop obesity, that's all that sort of thing. But we're not quite so sure about the benefits of self-regulation that physical development would need. So in physical play, given the opportunity, children will set goals for themselves. That's the important one, you know, they're in control, and they'll develop a strategy or strategies for achieving that goal. A simple example, just balancing along a plank. You know, stand up straight and look straight ahead. Okay. They then persevere in those actions, and they're very aware of when they succeed or indeed when they fail. But undaunted, they will persevere and try again. Why is this? Because again, it's their own goal. You know, they're not required to do it. They're setting their own goals. So they will try again, persevere, and it's that drive to achieve competence. And also, I think, to be in control of your body. And that's a very heady feeling for all of us, really, isn't it? You know? So, yes, I think that is, it's very useful to look at self-regulation being exhibited through physical play. We can provide good support for this. Shall I just indicate?
That would be lovely. Thank you. Yes.
Well, I think that it's very straightforward, really. One of the main things, just keeping to this balancing example, we're available and we're interested. Now, it's no more than that. You know, we're not being intrusive. We're not telling them how to do things, but we're there. And this, all it needs really is body language. It doesn't need any words, really. A thumbs up, a big smile, a big nod to show them that we're there and we really are, you know, encouraging and being affirmative. So that, I think, is probably one of the most important. Encouraging the child to struggle, though, you know, if he keeps falling off this plank and is beginning to get a bit disheartened, look, just try one more time. And there may be a gentle suggestion, but it's not telling him to do it, but just a little bit of advice maybe. Well, perhaps if you move a little more slowly, you know, put one foot in front of the other and move a little more slowly. He can reject that, but it's just a suggestion for him. And then what you're doing is sensitively withdrawing support when you see he's achieved, because this, what you've been offering him, is a form of light scaffold, really.
Yes.
And you can demonstrate when you feel, well, yes, he's there, he's achieved his goal, with another thumbs up and a nod and maybe a well done. You know, and you turn your attention to all the other children that need you. But most importantly, Kathy, I think, at all times you're allowing the child to make the decision about what he's doing. You know, you're not taking over at all.
From, if I've understood this correctly, that's throughout every activity, that's a constant almost philosophy of supporting children rather than stepping in and telling them how to do it or taking over their activities and just saying, oh, this is how you must do it, this is the one way, the one right way to do things. Am I right in that?
Yes, I do think that practitioners who, to my mind, are wonderful people, they really are wonderful and they work so hard. But there is a tendency to take over, to show them the way because we know better. And they'd be horrified, actually, I think, to realising that that's the case. It's a matter of standing back and letting the child grow themselves, you know.
It is very difficult to stand back and do that sometimes. If you see a child struggling or you think, if he just turns that jigsaw piece around, he'll have that. And it, you really do have to hold yourself back, don't you, in order to do that?
You do. Yes. You do. Yeah. So that requires your own self-regulation, doesn't it, really, in order to do that? You're restraining your impulses. You know, it's something that can apply in so many cases, really.
Absolutely, yes. And I think that maybe that is another top tip for practitioners. Just have a look at your own self-regulation. Do you always jump in? Do you know, maybe hold a mirror up to your own practice as well, which is good reflective practice anyway. Yes,
absolutely.
So what would your top tip be for then, your biggest tip for practitioners then, if they're trying to encourage children's self-regulation?
Well, I think I would say to them, look, quite a lot has been offered today, but when you get back to your room and you've had a session, just ask yourself, how much have I done today that young children could have done equally well for themselves? Now, obviously, we can't allow children to make all the decisions. Tina Bruce once said, quite rightly, at times the adult must lead and at times the child. Yes. But I do think it's a very good question, because if you're honest, you can identify when you've perhaps taken over, done too much, and children haven't got enough responsibility. Now, if they haven't got enough responsibility, that can lead to a bit of disaffection and poor behaviour. So we want to respect their ability to do as much for themselves as they can and stand back a little.
Yes, I think that respect is really core to that as well, isn't it? Just to have that bit of respect and maybe a little bit of trust that they will get there eventually. It might not be to our time scales, but they will get there in their own time scales, won't they?
What they've learned as a result, you know, That's the tip, what the child learned.
Yes, yes. And again, as adults, we're the same. We don't pick things up straight away. We have to have a two or three goes at things. And, you know, everything we learn, we usually do have to do that. So children aren't going to be a lot different from that, are they?
They're not.
So that we've looked at independence and we've looked at self-regulation and we've seen that there's quite a lot of overlap in there. If there's something that practitioners, just one thing that practitioners could implement tomorrow morning when they go into their setting, what would your one thing be to help children in independence and self-regulation and personal, social, emotional development?
Well, I would say we have to make sure that children can have this I can approach. And so you do need to be, I'm really offering a couple of suggestions here. You need to be very sure about those children who we call them sometimes the silent children we don't know enough about, those who are very tentative. And how are we going to help them feel I can? And it's a very, very slow process. But I think you have to have that in mind going into your classroom. And the other one is really to do with things, you know, looking around the room before the children come in. You've been very careful with the layout. It looks beautiful, very well organized and what have you. But how much is the here in my setting, in these activities, to really infuse children to think for themselves and have some intellectual challenge? I think it's that, really.
That, I think that's lovely, and that's those few quiet moments before the children arrive. And as you say, you look around and everything's there. That would be a great little question just to have. I might have that on the back of the staff room door as they leave. Just have a look at your environment and think, is this challenging the children? Yeah, that's lovely. Thank you very, very much indeed, Marion Dowling. As always, a great pleasure to talk with you, and especially about PSED, because as I say, this is my favourite book on PSED. I'd highly recommend it to anybody. And thank you very much indeed to our viewers and listeners today for joining us on the Early Years Web Summit.
Thank you, Cathy. Been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you, Marion.